good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loride. Coming up, we'll hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night. It's a discussion about state and local politics. We'll hear that in just a moment. And later on, we'll open up the phone lines. Also, yesterday marked the 40th anniversary of the trial over the Arthur McDuffie killing after the four officers were found not guilty, who were accused of killing Arthur McDuffie. There were large riots in Miami, and we'll look back on that incident 40 years ago yesterday. First, two listener comments about last week's shows. Last week, we discussed a lot of topics, including Joe Biden and the military flyover and fake medical videos. Here's what some listeners had to say.
This is Martin from Palm Harbor. I'm calling to say that I, for one, was disappointed that Joe Biden said he would pick a woman as his running mate. By doing so, he has essentially said the sex of his running mate is more important than his or her qualifications and electability. We need the best person running with him, regardless of gender.
This is Howard, just north of Atlanta. On the crisis issue, look out Dr. Bennett Umalu, U-M-A-L-U. He brought to light the NFL's maltreatment of players who suffer brain trauma. Look at how he was treated, not only by the NFL, but by the medical establishment he dared to criticize. Take the CDC, for example, who didn't issue one warning against smoking until 1964, and only after 7,000 analyses were submitted. You can find that on the CDC website. I don't know about Dr. Mikovits' science, but there's always two sides to a story. Second point is about income taxation. This will never going to change until we get a majority of true patriots in Congress and in the White House. There's several ways to implement fair taxation for wealthy and for not wealthy, none of which will be approved by the currently elected officials because those changes would cause a significant reduction in political contributions. And speaking of true patriots, we are speaking of our enlisted and underpaid service women and men, and the expectations we've always had of them to defend not only our freedom, but the freedom of the people around the globe. It's been 75 years since we sent our soldiers and flyers and sailors into a battle which we could all support, but they still deserve our mutual respect and admiration today. So when they decide to return the salute to us in some way, I think we should all graciously accept that salute without position or agenda.
Some listener comments that came in after Friday's program. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We're going to hear Florida This Week, and as we listen back to it, you're welcome to send your email comments into the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. Here is Florida This Week. Coming up next, it's been 11 weeks since the first case of COVID-19 was discovered in Florida. The number of dead in the state has climbed to nearly 2,000. The official unemployment number stands at 1.4 million. We'll get perspective from labor, business, medicine, and the press next on a special edition of Florida This Week. Welcome back. Florida slowly reopened more businesses this week. This time, it was barbershops, hair, and nail salons' turn, but they were required to take extraordinary steps to keep customers apart and work areas sanitized. The state's official unemployment numbers grew to 1.4 million, with less than half of those receiving any sort of unemployment compensation so far from the state's troubled system. Two pillars of the state's economy, tourism and agriculture, have been hit hard, so much so that state revenue will be down by billions. According to the Tampa Bay Times, the impact on the state budget could be felt for years. March's sales taxes were down about $773 million. Revenue for April will be even worse. That's brought some people to call for a special session of the legislature to re-examine the state's next budget. And a new report by the Institute for Health Metrics predicts fatalities from COVID-19 in Florida will continue to climb for the next 3 months, reaching as many as 5,400 dead by the 1st of August. Returning now to discuss those numbers is Dr. Donna Peterson, a professor of public health at USF and the dean of the College of Public Health. She earned her master's and doctoral degrees from the Johns Hopkins School of Hygiene and Public Health. Dr. Peterson, welcome back to Florida This Week.
Thanks, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to start by asking you about this Japanese viral video that's going around that shows that a man putting fluorescent paint in his hand and then going into a restaurant and eating, and the restaurant is kind of a buffet-style restaurant, and before you know it, they use black light to illuminate this, before you know it, there is fluorescent paint everywhere, and this is a stand-in for the virus. Is this how viruses spread?
Well, Rob, sadly, this is how viruses spread, which is why we continue to urge everyone to wash their hands frequently, warm soapy water for 20 seconds, and to disinfect surfaces frequently. That video may be slightly, because he put more paint on his hand than likely there would be virus in your hand, it was probably more, it was a more dramatic spread than you would normally see, but that is exactly how viruses spread. It doesn't take much. If it's on your hands and you touch a surface and it stays on the surface, someone else touches that surface, and you can see how quickly and how far that that paint spread. That is how it spreads.
When you see a video of people that are standing shoulder to shoulder at protests, or you're seeing people now returning to bars and sitting at the bar, do you have any concerns about the way the country is reopening?
Well, it makes me nervous because the guidance we've been giving since the very beginning hasn't changed. Maintaining that physical distance of at least 6 feet, wearing face coverings, this reduces the spread of the transmission through droplets. And then there's the surface transmission that we just spoke about. But it does make me nervous that people don't seem to be heeding that guidance, even though we have active viral transmission continuing to occur in our communities. So it's a concern.
I want to play a video. This is from Meet the Press a week ago, and it's Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research at the University of Minnesota. Let's play that video.
Somewhere between now and tomorrow, next year, we're going to see 60 to 70% of Americans ultimately infected with this virus. What we have to do is figure out how not just to die with the virus, but also how to live with it. And we're not having that discussion. As Lewis Carroll once said, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. And right now, that's where we're at.
So, Dr. Peterson, in that, Dr. Osterholm suggests that we have to have 60 to 80% of the country infected before we're out of this. Is that the way most public health officials view this?
Well, what Dr. Osterholm is referring to there, I believe, is the level of population immunity we need to achieve what's called herd immunity. So when 60 to 80% of the population is immune to COVID-19, we have herd immunity, and it is much more difficult for that virus to be transmitted. So he's right. It doesn't mean we need 60 to 80% of the population infected and severely ill. It means we need 60 to 80% immune. And that immunity could come from low-level disease. We know some people are asymptomatic. Some people have mild forms of the disease. It can come from a vaccine. And that's why vaccines are a very important part of how we build herd immunity for any communicable disease. So he's calculating that on that R-naught that we've talked about, that transmission rate. And so it's 1 minus 1 divided by the R-naught will get you the percentage of the population that needs to be immune before you can stop the transmission of the virus. So he's not wrong.
So how long before we get to that point based on the numbers that you're looking at?
Well, again, we're very anxiously awaiting a vaccine. We're not sure when that's going to be achieved, but that is a huge part of, again, the way we build herd immunity. Other than that, we're waiting for people to become exposed and have the disease. And again, as I said, we want to not have people have severe disease, which means we want to protect those people at highest risk. So we will be slowly building herd immunity among the lower risk members of our communities, while we continue to protect the high risk. And
is there,
to.
Is there a way to avoid that number? I'm wondering if we all sheltered in place, or everybody were to, you know, self-quarantine if they think that they have it or come down with it, is there any way to avoid getting up to those high numbers?
Not without a vaccine.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the vaccine. On Friday, the president said that he thinks that by the end of this year, there may be a vaccine available that we can use. What are the scientists, what are the people in public health saying about the prospects for a vaccine on the horizon? How soon might we see a vaccine?
Well, we're very proud of our colleagues, the scientists and the professionals who are working overtime to try to develop a vaccine as quickly as possible. The truth is, though, it takes a while to develop an effective vaccine. It has to go through multiple stages of testing, and coronaviruses are challenging to create a vaccine against. So this one's a little tough, but people are putting everything they have toward this goal. It's absolutely critical. As you say, we would much prefer to achieve herd immunity through a vaccine. So I would love to believe that the president's optimism is well-placed. I've heard other people say that they're hopeful. So, of course, we're all hopeful, and we're going to rally around and support our scientists as best we can, but we just have to wait and see.
You sound a little bit skeptical that the end of the year is possible.
That's only 6 months away, and that's typically it takes 12 to 18 months to develop a vaccine, so we're within that window, kind of.
Kind of. Dr. Donna Peterson, thank you so much for coming on Florida This Week.
Thanks, Rob. It's always a pleasure.
It's great to have you here. You too. Thank you. Joining me now is Steve Bousquet, a columnist for the Orlando Sentinel and the South Florida Sun Sentinel newspapers. Previously, he was the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Tampa Bay Times, the Miami Herald. Steve, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks, Rob. It's good to see you too.
I want to ask you about the governor's plans for Monday. What does he plan to do regarding reopening on Monday?
Well, it's phase two. He calls it full phase one, but it means, for example, that restaurants in Florida can expand and use 50% of their seating capacity with the spacing that's required under the CDC rules. Museums are going to open. Libraries will be back open. Gyms and fitness centers will be open as well. Still, no bars, no movie theaters. I didn't hear that in his announcement in Jacksonville on Friday. So that's where we stand.
Steve, there have been several reports about the downturn in sales tax revenue for the state, and there have been some Democrats that say that the budget that's supposed to go into effect July 1st, there should be a special session to revisit that budget because state revenues, all the forecasts say it's going to be down. Tom Lee said it's going to be down by billions. What do you know?
Well, the budget that the legislature passed on March 19th, I think, is a complete work of fiction at this point. That's not really the legislature's fault. The timing was that the coronavirus pandemic was just beginning to build when they had that, if you remember, brief extended special session to pass the budget, $93.2 billion. But DeSantis is going to have to aggressively veto a lot of things in the budget. And the things that are most on people's minds that could be vetoed, I say could, I don't know, is a pay raise for state employees. That's a big ticket item. And the protection, the preservation of the Sadowski Fund, the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. But there's no question DeSantis is going to veto a lot of projects. The Democrats are furious. I think they should be, because of the unwillingness of the Republican leadership to want to call the legislature back, even under social distancing restrictions, to discuss this. They've, in effect, left everything in DeSantis's hands. And, of course, DeSantis is delaying acting on the budget until he knows if there's more money coming from Washington. That's a very important aspect of this.
Has the governor put his foot down and said absolutely no to a special session?
No, I don't think so. But, you know, keep in mind, the legislature could call themselves back into special session. I don't even get a strong sense that DeSantis is really working collaboratively with the legislative leadership. He doesn't have to. Let's take a step back here. We're under a state of emergency, and under that pretext, in this state, the governor has very broad powers to act independently, as DeSantis has been doing. Some of what he's done has been widely criticized. Some of what he's done has been met with lots of praise. With this most recent step, with gradually reopening the state and getting South Florida back to where it's catching up to the rest of the state, he's got a lot of local political support for those changes.
The Democrats say that what they would like to do, at least some of them would like to do, is eliminate the corporate tax break that was passed by this session of the legislature. I think it's $500 million in tax breaks for corporations. Is that DOA, or would the legislature consider that?
That's not going to happen. It is not going to happen, and the legislature, this legislature, would never consider any new revenue sources. They might in the most extreme situations. You remember a little over a decade ago, we went through the Great Recession. Charlie Crist was governor. What did we do? Under duress, Charlie Crist increased tag fees and car registration fees. Very controversial, later repealed by Rick Scott. This legislature doesn't even want to go there. That's going to necessitate a lot of cutting. And people are beginning to worry about, will there be cuts in K-12 education? Are there going to be cuts in healthcare? Because not only are millions of people suffering, Rob, as you know, but everybody expects there's going to be a big spike in Medicaid caseloads. There's going to be a greater demand for Medicaid in the state because many people have lost their health insurance.
Steve, we're down to the last minute. I want to ask you about unemployment. The governor, I think it's fair to say, thinks that if it wasn't for the huge number of people, this wouldn't be a problem. But Democratic members of Congress across Florida, all 13 members of the delegation, are saying they want a federal investigation into the way the state's unemployment system operates. What's the latest on the unemployment system?
The latest on it is that despite efforts to ramp up call centers and bolster the system, and Ron DeSantis said on Friday that close to $2 billion have been paid out in claims, still many people are hurting. I listened to a forum with Democrats from the congressional delegation where they had a limousine driver on and another unemployed man from South Florida. These people are, Rob, they're in truly desperate straits, and the frustration was palpable coming through your virtual press conferences. Not enough is being done to help these unemployed folks, and this state is in dire economic straits, and I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And this unemployment website is not fixed, and there's really no solution here, except there's going to be a lot more frustration.
Steve Bosquet, thank you very much. Good to see you, and to be continued.
Always good to see you, Rob. Thanks.
Well, another 220,000 people filed unemployment claims here in Florida last week, bringing the total to at least 1.4 million across the state. And that's not counting the people who are unable to navigate Florida's broken unemployment system. Here to talk about it is Dr. Rich Templin, the Director of Politics and Public Policy for the Florida chapter of the AFL-CIO. Rich, nice to see you. Hope you're doing well.
Nice to see you, sir. Big fan. It's an honor.
So, Rich, tell me about the unemployment system. I've seen quotes from members of the state legislature who are Republicans who are saying that the problems are fixed. The governor's pretty upbeat about it. And the guy that they brought in to fix the system, he's pretty upbeat. What do you say from labor standpoint?
Well, there have been some improvements made to the system, only in terms of accessibility, only in terms of getting those applications into the right hands. But that's it. And that really is just the tip of the iceberg for Florida's broken system. I've got to go back a little bit historically to kind of explain how we got here. After the 2008 recession, as the economy began to tank and unemployment went up, we had the way that the unemployment insurance trust fund works is there's a statutory trigger. So as the amount of money in the fund falls to a certain level, there is an increase on businesses for the premiums that they pay on their employees. And that's designed to keep the trust fund solvent. In 2006, 2007, and again in 2008, the business lobby went to the legislature and said, please don't raise our premiums. Please don't raise our taxes, is what they called it. And they didn't. The legislature agreed. And so by the end of 2008, the trust fund was going insolvent. The Florida legislature took millions of dollars from the Obama stimulus package. Interestingly enough, while completely deriding it as socialism, they were taking that money and they were using it to prop up the trust fund so that businesses didn't have to pay their fair share into it. Flash forward to 2010, 2011, Governor Rick Scott takes office and they realize that the trust fund was completely insolvent. We were in debt to the federal government for tens of millions of dollars. And everybody knew that finally the business community was going to have to see an increase in those premiums. But then they came upon an interesting idea. What if they left the low premiums, some of the lowest in the country, what if they kept them very low and instead changed the way benefits were granted so that no money ever left the fund? So you would still have a trickle of money going in, no money coming out in the form of employee benefits, and that would rebuild the fund. And that's what they did. They radically altered the system, including creating the online-only application method, the website, the platform that has completely failed. And it's important to note that many entities have told them that it was failing and would fail if we saw a big uptick in unemployment. But they also did other things. They dramatically reduced the number of weeks that workers were eligible for benefits by tying it to the unemployment rate. They reduced the maximum weekly benefit amount. They switched some legal presumptions in the past. And I'm oversimplifying a little bit. But in the past, it was assumed if a worker was unemployed that they would qualify for benefits. That was the legal assumption. It would then be up to the business owner to prove that for whatever reason that worker was ineligible for benefits. Well, they reversed that, putting the burden of proof on the employee as opposed to the employer. So now every employee who's laid off has to essentially prove that they're eligible for benefits. One of the reasons that the application process takes 4 or 5 hours and multiple times. So all of that is now coming to a head. The benefit workers are being denied even once they get through the application process. The benefit amount is a paltry amount. It's certainly not enough to do the job that the unemployment insurance system was designed for. And that's what we're seeing today. And that's why we're trying to get the governor to act under his powers granted him under the emergency declaration.
So you think he's got the powers to fix this pretty quickly?
We do. I mean, we've seen him waive statutes. We've seen him alter statutes without any legislative action. This is the only area that he's saying he can't do anything about, that he needs the legislature to step in. We don't think that's accurate. And even if it is, then the legislature needs to get on this right away. I think too many people see unemployment insurance as some type of welfare program for workers. It's not. It's business insurance. It was designed after the Great Recession so that workers in times of high layoff have spending power so they can continue to pump money into their local economies. We've got $4 billion in this trust fund. The law is keeping it from getting into the hands of the people who need it and keeping it out of the cash register of local businesses.
Dr. Rich Templin, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on WEDU.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for having me.
Many Florida restaurants have begun the process of reopening across the state and here in the Tampa Bay area. But with the social distancing requirements and limits on how many people can be inside at once, it's not been easy. Some restaurants have chosen to cease operations altogether. Joining us now is Travis Kaiser, the manager and partner for Daily Eats, a well-known eating establishment in Tampa. Travis, nice to see you. Thank you for coming on Florida this week.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
So you guys are up and running. Is it hard to maintain social distance at Daily Eats?
It's certainly a challenge, but everybody's been really patient and understanding. you haven't had to have, you know, security or anything, but for the most part, people are keeping their own distance. It's not, you know, we don't have to bring in the authorities to maintain that. So it's been fairly easy, actually.
What happened to your employees during the break when you were ordered to shut down and you couldn't serve? What happened to the employees? How many employees do you have?
We're about 75%, and we laid off about, I would say, 90%. We stayed open for takeout and delivery, which, you know, the first couple of weeks were a little scary, but then it, you know, started to build steam, and then we're able to bring some people back fairly quickly. Over the first kind of 3 weeks, we were down, but after that, we kind of, you know, got it back.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the government is acting on the right pace? For instance, is Governor DeSantis doing the right thing by opening things up slowly and asking you to keep the 6-foot distance within the restaurant, 25% capacity? Is he on the right track?
I think it's good in a lot of ways. I think you know, as the new norm changes, our operations have changed. So it kind of gives us an opportunity to slowly move into it and you know, make changes to go rather than, you know, coming to full capacity and then, you know, things are hard to execute. So I like how it's been so far. We haven't really came into any huge issues. So, so far, so good. I like it.
Do you expect to eventually bring back all the employees that once worked there at Dave Meats?
The goal, that's the goal right now. Business isn't exactly, you know, dictating that right now, but over some time, we have to get everybody back, and you know, that's been the goal from the beginning. It's hard, you know, you form relationships with these people. They help you make money and help you support your own families and things like that, and the last thing you want to do is see them hurting, see them, you know, about not being able to pay their bills and everything else. So it's tough, and we wish things would kind of come back faster, but to kind of go back, you know, I think the triple effect is definitely the way to go about it.
The city government, the city of Tampa, has a program that offers grants to small businesses. Also, the federal government is offering some help to businesses. Did you take part in any of those government programs? Were they helpful? Or if you didn't take part, why didn't you take part?
We did, you know, we got some help, and it's been a huge help to get most of our staff back. That was a major factor of bringing our staff back, and you know, everything so far has been really helpful. You know, we're one of the lucky ones to continue to have a pretty good business model going, and it kept us afloat for the time, you know, the first month or so. And then as that help came in, we were able to bring people back and gave us a little bit more comfort of, you know, to make sure that we were able to sustain it all.
Travis, is there anything that you'd like to see government do in the future to make sure that businesses come back? Because we're reading that some restaurants are closing their doors permanently. Is there anything more that either the local, state, or federal government could do to help you out?
You know, I don't know. It's tough. Nobody really knows. I feel like that, you know, there's a destination and we're taking lefts and rights to get there instead of going straight. And I think that's the right way to go about it. But I don't know, you know, it's a hard question to answer because it's just, we're just trying to make people safe. And, you know, we have staff and guests that, you know, are coming in, and we just hope that everybody stays safe and this thing goes away. That's the goal. So, you know, it's hard to answer that. You know, I think they've done a lot with letting us use tents and shutting down some of the roads to, you know, maximize your capacity to bring some more money in. And, you know, the city's been great. You know, they've reached out to see if there's anything we need or anything. So, so far, so good.
So, Travis, I see the plexiglass behind you. So it looks like you've put in a lot of stuff since I was there last. Thank you for coming on WEDU. It's good to have you here, and I hope everything goes well.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, finally, the coronavirus has spurred a tidal wave of creativity, videos, poetry, comedy, and parodies. And because I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan, we go out with this parody of Rainy Day Women. Stay safe. We'll see you next week. Feel so all alone, but everybody
Well, that was Florida This Week from this past Friday night. And if you want to comment about anything that we discussed there, you can send your email into the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. And my guests on that program were Travis Kaiser, who's the manager of the Daily Eats restaurant in South Tampa, Rich Templin with the Florida AFL-CIO in Tallahassee, Steve Bosquet covers politics for the Orlando Sentinel and the Florida Sun Sentinel, and he's also a columnist and an editorial board member of those newspapers. And Donna Peterson is the dean of the College of Public Health at USF in Tampa. And one of the topics that came up was unemployment, and David writes this about the governor and unemployment. David writes, I think the governor ruined his reelection efforts. His comments blaming the unemployed people on the problems with the Florida unemployment system is ridiculous and wrong. He needs to acknowledge that Rick Scott built a frustration algorithm into the program. It was designed to frustrate, not to help, writes David. And then Doug in Clearwater writes, how in heck does Rick DeSantis blamed the unemployed for this problem? I may not have read as many reports as I should have and may have gotten his name wrong, but I know you know what I'm saying, writes Doug in Clearwater. Actually, the story broke late Friday afternoon, and it was this, that the governor held a press conference on Friday afternoon in Jacksonville, and he made a controversial statement about the unemployed. Governor DeSantis said some Floridians waiting on unemployment checks have themselves to blame for not filling out their applications properly. And I'm reading from the Tampa Bay Times coverage. During an exchange with a reporter during a Friday news conference in Jacksonville, DeSantis expressed frustration with the news stories that, quote, Floridians who've been unable to receive either state or federal benefits. The governor said that for people who applied in March or early April, Florida's Department of Economic Opportunity later learns that their applications were not filled out properly. DeSantis said some people haven't entered their Social Security number or their wages. This is what the governor said on Friday. And the governor said the Department of Economic Opportunity goes through this, and 9 times out of 10, the application is incomplete, said the governor. And I think if you've applied in that time period and your application's complete and you qualify, I think 99.99% of those folks have been paid. Statement was roundly criticized on Twitter by Democratic lawmakers and out-of-work Floridians who have been stymied by Florida's Byzantine and broken unemployment system. So that's part of the controversy generated Friday afternoon as we were taping that show, the governor blaming the unemployed themselves for not filling out the unemployment forms correctly. So again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. If you want to comment about any of this, or you can email us here in the studio, the address is dj@wmnf.org. Well, back in December of 1979, a 33-year-old insurance agent and former Marine was beaten into a coma by up to a dozen white Dade County police officers. The victim was black. The victim had ran a red light on his motorcycle. The officers immediately tried to cover up their crime to stage it as an accident. And yesterday, 40 years ago, an all-white jury in Tampa acquitted the officers. That led to riots breaking out in Miami. Now, earlier today, the BBC looked back at the Arthur McDuffie killing and the riots that broke out in Liberty City. And we're going to hear the report right now that we carried this morning on WMNF's HD3. Here's a report about the McDuffie killing and the Miami riots that took place 40 years ago yesterday.
On the 17th of May, 1980, race riots erupted in Miami, Florida. They left 18 people dead, hundreds injured, and millions of dollars worth of damage to property, after white policemen were acquitted of the killing of an African-American man. I've been speaking to a former police officer and childhood friend of the victim.
We know know that we are now at war with people here that keep pushing us around.
That's right.
We can no longer take it.
A policeman called what happened uncontrolled violence against whites. But blacks attack blacks, too. This woman's husband had been badly beaten. In all, 113 beating cases were...
The riots broke out after four white police officers were acquitted of the manslaughter of a 33-year-old black insurance salesman, Arthur McDuffie. He'd been beaten by the police after jumping a red light on his motorbike. He died in hospital a few days later. The police had driven over his motorbike to make it look like it had an accident.
I can remember the sergeant who was assigned to internal affairs at the time walked over to my office and she said to me, I need to talk to you about something because we are going to have a problem with this case. This is not an accident. And when this comes out, it's going to be bad.
Police officer Lonnie Lawrence had recently been put in charge of public affairs for Dade County Public Safety Department, the police force involved.
She told me that the last name of the victim was McDuffie. I said, okay. I said, what's his first name? And she said, Arthur. And I sort of sat back in my chair and I said, Arthur McDuffie? I said, how old was he? Do you know his occupation? And I started asking her questions and she looked at me and she said, what's wrong? I said, you know, this guy, I grew up with this guy. I was in a Marine Corps with this guy. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, I'm going to have a hard time with this one. A very hard time.
Arthur McDuffie was fatally beaten here on this spot after a high-speed police chase.
He died as a result of blunt head injuries with destruction of his underlying brain. He was beaten to death.
They beat my child to death. They beat him to death like a dog. Like a dog. They beat him to death like a dog.
For Lonnie Lawrence, as an African-American policeman, it was a very difficult time.
I had thoughts of quitting. And then I thought, but wait a minute. If I quit, that's one less of us who's there to try to make sure that things change. I can't make a change outside the system, but I could try to effectuate some change along with others within the system. And that drove me to stay.
The trial of the officers accused of Arthur McDuffie's manslaughter was moved from Miami to Tampa, where it was heard by an all-white, all-male jury. Lonnie Lawrence was out with Director of Police Bobby Jones when the verdict was announced.
We were out in Liberty City doing a community against crime thing when I got the word that the jury had come back with a decision. And the word that I got was that decision was not guilty on all counts, for all of them, which absolutely blew my mind. And I stepped back over to the director and I told him, I said, we need to leave. And we got in the car and we were driving away and I said, the jury found them all not guilty. I can't begin to tell you what he said to me. because neither one of us could actually believe that they would all found not guilty on all charges. But then, as we're riding along, I said to him, you need to mobilize the department because there is going to be some problems. He said, really? I said, yeah, there's going to be some problems. There's no doubt in my mind because people are sick and tired of this kind of stuff happening.
Several decisions were handed down in Tampa that shocked many of us, tore a lot of us apart inside, and made us extremely emotional.
Injustice! Injustice!
By the time Lonnie Lawrence and Bobby Jones had arrived back at police headquarters, people were already taking to the streets.
We started making calls, started organizing, and started getting things in place and getting people in place to try to respond. And as I'm standing there in my office and looking out, I'm wondering, okay, when is it going to happen? Where is it going to happen? And how bad is it going to happen? And I looked down the street, and a crowd was coming down the street toward the headquarters building. And I called him, and I said, listen, I need to get off the phone right now. I said, because we got a crowd of folk coming down 14th Street, and they are not a happy bunch. I can see it. I said, let me go downstairs and try to see what's going on. And sure enough, I went downstairs, and they were getting ready to come inside the building. And I said, no, don't do that, because it's not going to be a good thing, because there are people inside this building who are armed. And we don't need any more bloodshed. We really don't. And they back out of the door and went around the corner in front of the Justice Building, and they held a demonstration in front of the Justice Building. And shortly after that demonstration started, the first vehicle was torched and burned.
The large crowd began to move through the city. At a police building, they broke windows and overturned cars, setting them on fire.
And from that point on, it was like spontaneous combustion, because there were things happening all over the place, and people being drug out of cars, cars being rocked and bottled. And of course, that went on for, 3 days?
For a second night in a row, authorities say the predominantly black northwest section of Miami has been turned into a war zone as people burn buildings at will. 51 major fires were reported during the night, along with hundreds of smaller blazes.
In an area where things were already not where they should be, some of those things and some of those businesses never came back. And they were businesses that the community depended on. And that's the disheartening thing about it, is that it took the community further into despair than it already was.
Black community leaders and the police tried to improve relationships.
It takes a while to build back trust in a community that have heard promises, but not saw the results of those promises. And I can tell you that even today, there are still people who have their concerns about the system doing what it should do.
Lonnie Lawrence rose to the rank of major within the police before becoming director of the Miami-Dade Corrections and Rehabilitation Department. He was speaking to me, Sheila Cook, for this edition of Witness History.
And that appeared on the BBC this morning. 40 years ago yesterday, an all-white jury in Tampa acquitted four Miami police officers of the killing of Arthur McDuffie, a 33-year-old African-American insurance salesman and Marine veteran. And he was killed as he was riding on his motorcycle, ran a red light, and was surrounded by police officers and beaten nearly to death. He died a few days later. The trial took place in Tampa, and the jury was announcing its verdict 40 years ago yesterday, and that resulted in the so-called Liberty City riots. And we could talk about that. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. You know, my memory about that, too, is just a small thing, but Gil Scott-Heron was playing in Tampa the night of the jury trial ending in Tampa. And it just seemed to me that at the very end, Gil had something to say at the very end of his concert about the McDuffie verdict. Well, again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. And if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, or if there's something in the news that you want to comment about, you can email the studio here. The address is dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Mike in Tampa, who wants to say something. Mike, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Yeah, I think the government blaming the unemployed for the unemployment situation is just trying to resolve itself a blame.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to hear from the unemployed people. If they feel like they've filled out the form wrong, the governor says that 99.99% of the people who are complaining have filled out the form wrong. I know people, I've talked to three or four people who've spent a lot of time filling out those forms. They got turned down or they couldn't get through the process because they had to keep refiling Social Security and other numbers. It seems like a very frustrating process for those people that I've talked with, and I doubt they've spent hours filling out the forms, so I doubt that they would make a mistake after spending hours and hours and hours. But
yeah,
we'll
I
see.
I don't believe that 99% would have filled out the form wrong.
Yeah, I don't believe that either. But, you know, if the governor has proof, you know, maybe he can put that proof out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Mike, thanks a lot.
Mm.
All right, good to hear from you. 813-239-9663 is the number to call if you want to call in. And let's go to Mark in Lake Wales. Mark, thanks for calling in. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob, yeah, I was about 13 years old when these riots were going on in Miami. And pretty disturbing, the news clips of what these cops were doing. But, yeah, I remember it was pretty bad. Liberty City, they caught a tire store on fire, and it burned black smoke for probably 2 weeks. And I would see this as a child growing up. Other than that's really all I got to say, Ron.
All right, Mark. Did you grow up in Miami?
Yeah, I did. My father moved us there when I was nine.
Yeah,
Miami Lakes area, but we were pretty sheltered from everything that was going on. But I was maybe 10 miles away from Liberty City. And I know the National Guard came in, and they cut off food stamps, and that kind of turned things around. Hey, thanks, Rob.
All right, Mark. Thanks for your thoughts. I just want to say, too, that Uber has laid off 3,000 more employees. That announcement came this morning, and that was the second round, at least the second round of layoffs at Uber. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. The FBI has found a link between the Saudi gunman in that deadly attack at the Pensacola military base and an Al-Qaeda operative. That attack took place a few months ago. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Bonnie in St. Petersburg. Bonnie, thanks for calling in. How are you?
Good. So I want to speak to the unemployment problem. I've been attempting to apply since March 18th, and I'm one of those people that are in limbo. I've spent so many hours every day applying, and I'm a member of a Facebook page along with 15,000 others, and it's growing. So the fact that the numbers are still going up, you know, speaks volumes to me.
Bonnie, what's the name of the Facebook page for other unemployed people that might want to join?
Yes, it's called Florida Unemployment Problems COVID-19.
Okay. I'll have to look that up. So when the governor says that 99% of the people who are not successful in getting unemployment insurance, that they're not filling out the forms correctly, if the governor was here on this radio show, what would you say to the governor?
I would say that he's incorrect. There are so many of us, and the numbers still are climbing, that are having the same issues. You know, and when we're all having the same issues, there's a problem. It is the sight. I don't believe that our government officials want us to collect unemployment. They want us to go back to work. And I, for one, am not willing to go back to work at this point. You know, I'm elderly. I'm immune compromised. And I don't feel safe out there. So what are you going to do to fix the system? And please be specific.
And even if you go back to work, he still owes you going back to, you said March 18th?
Yes. I started applying on March 18th, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Bonnie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Hope the problem gets solved. Let's go to Dominic in Bradenton. Hi, Dominic. You're on WMNF. What's up?
Hey, Rob. I called a few weeks ago because I was having issues with the unemployment situation, and you provided some good information to me, some good in contacting state representatives and so forth. My situation is a little bit different in that I was unemployed in January. So I was already in the system when the pandemic hit and the president signed the CARES Act. And I was told by my career source job coach and by people when I did get through the DEO that I didn't need to do anything to continue my benefits. I'm already in the system. My benefits, state benefits, ran out April 11th was the last week I got paid. So now it's 5-6 weeks later. I have not seen another nickel of the extended benefits nor the $600 weekly benefits. And again, that you can't get through to the DEO office. Last Thursday evening and every Thursday evening, the local ABC station down in Sarasota and Bradenton, they have at 7 o'clock, they have a forum where Congressman Vern Buchanan is on. And last Thursday, Representative Joe Gruters was on. And I asked a question, I emailed them a question earlier in the week, and they actually aired it that Thursday, because the benefits that I qualify for, the extended 13 weeks of unemployment benefits, are the PEUC benefits. And that question was asked of Joe Gruters, and he says, all you got to do is go on the site and click on the link and apply for those benefits. Well, the only link on the site is the PUA benefits, which I don't qualify for. And under PEUC benefits that they explain, after they explain what that's for, it says you can't apply for them just yet. More information to come.
Huh. Well, Dominic, have you called Gruter's office and tried to talk with him directly?
I have called Gruter's office a couple of times. One time they called me and said they would have to call me back after they found out some answers.
Did they ever call you back?
They called me back a second time, but I was in a meeting and I couldn't take the call, so I called them back again, and they did not reply or left a message again. Ironically, I received a phone number from a friend of mine who had gotten it from Vern Buchanan's office. He said, call this number. They should be able to help you out regarding your situation. And I called the number. It was actually Governor Ron DeSantis' office. And they did call me back on Friday. A gal called me back, took my information, said she was going to forward the information to the DEO office, and someone would call me probably sometime this week to resolve the issue. So I'm still hopeful that they can get to the bottom of it. When I go on the DEO site, my account doesn't have accurate start dates and so forth. It says my start date is April 26th, but yet I've already received 12 weeks of benefits. So obviously something's wrong there. Someone's put in the wrong information. So I didn't even have to apply. I mean, the governor says that all you have to do is go on and apply for the benefits, and if you don't get the benefits is because you didn't fill out the application correct. Well, I didn't have to fill out anything, and I still don't have the benefits. So I don't know what his answer is to that. Probably doesn't understand that or realize that there are people that were unemployed prior to the pandemic hitting that can't even apply for the benefits yet, because according to the DEO website, there's no link for the PEUC benefits yet.
Yeah. Well, I would still try to call Gruter's office. I know you were in a meeting, but try to get them to give you a straight answer.
Yeah, I called him back after that, and he seems to be legitimately trying to help people. So
let's hope he does. All right, Dominic, thanks a lot. Boy, you've got a big problem. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment about the program today on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks for listening. This is WMNF Tampa. Sean Canan is coming up in the next hour with the Midpoint program. The floor. I should say that Sean is going to have the action group for COVID unemployment. He's going to have somebody from that group on in the next hour, so stick around.